I'd like you to think this morning about three people. Let me tell you who they are, okay? Are you ready? First one I'd like you to think of and picture in your mind is your best friend. I mean, your all-time best friend in the whole wide world, okay? Pick somebody there now. Got him? Okay, next person I want you to picture in your mind is someone seated in your row that you don't know. But maybe you've seen them around here. You don't know their name. So go ahead and look down the row. See, find somebody there. Somebody you don't know very well. Don't know their name. All right. Got them? Picture that person in your mind. You've seen them at PCC before, but you really don't know them. Okay? Third person. I want you to think of a pastor. Okay? Doesn't have to be me. Just a pastor. You think of, maybe get a pastor you know, though. It can be Tony or Dan or Mark or me or whoever. Or if you're from another church, some your pastor. Think of your pastor, okay? Got all three of those in your mind? Picture them. Best friend, somebody in your row, your pastor. Okay, ready? Scenario. You are traveling northbound on I-5. It's about 10 till 8 in the morning, and you get caught in a terrible traffic jam somewhere between Crown Valley Parkway and Oso Parkway, right? This is not hard to imagine. You realize you have a flat tire, a bad one. By the time you get over to the shoulder of the freeway, you're like riding on the rim. That's how bad it is. Really bad flat tire. Now, if you have AAA, it expired last month, okay? Your cell phone, you forgot it. It's not there. And the spare in your trunk, you remember, never got repaired from last year's flat tire. Okay, so that's your scenario. Got it? First guy to drive up in the snarled, slow, 2-mile-an-hour traffic is me. It's your pastor. If you didn't think of me, it's whoever you thought of. I roll the window down as I'm cruising by, and I say, "Hey, flat tire. Bummer." It's terrible. Well, gotta go. See you Sunday. Okay? Got it? You've made the mental note. Find new church. Okay. Next car pulls up. It's that guy in the row there. You don't know his name. That person there in that row, and you've seen them at PCC, and they cruise by and they roll down their window and they say, "Hey, PCC here, what's going on?" And you say, "Duh, flat tire." And they say, "Wow, got a spare?" You say, "No." They say, "You idiot, what are you doing driving on the freeway without a spare tire? They shouldn't let people like you on the road." Okay? At last, you see the car of your best friend pulling up. Ah, sense of relief washes over you. They roll the window down. You say, "Wow, am I glad to see you." And they say, "That tire, that flat, it's no mistake. It's no accident. As a matter of fact, I was thinking of cutting your brake lines. You ought to be glad I just sabotaged the tire." And by the way, maybe this will get you to think how to treat your friends. And maybe next time you won't treat your friends as lousy as you've treated me the last few years. By the way, don't ever expect to hear from me again. Wow. Now hopefully that will never happen to you. But unfortunately, I hate to tell you, you will have those feelings. And you will have those feelings in situations in your life, problems and crises in your life, that are a whole lot less obvious than a flat tire. You'll be struggling, you'll be hurting, and you will feel neglected, abandoned, you will feel lonely, you will feel criticized, and you'll feel betrayed. And you'll have those feelings of pain. And when that kind of pain, that kind of emotional abandonment sets in, you can really see your Christian life take 10 steps backwards. It can be devastating. It can rock your faith. It can make you question everything you believe. It can get you real mad at God. Or, believe it or not, it can move you a few steps forward in your walk with Christ. The difference between taking 10 steps backwards and 2 steps forward is all in how you respond. And if you're ready and prepared to deal with that kind of rejection. This morning, I'd like us to learn from the life of King David, in the midst of one of his worst trials, things that will help us make the most of that kind of pain. And it will be for us, I hope, the thing that keeps us moving forward in our Christian life. I want to show you both the good side and the bad side from 2 Samuel chapter 16, from a terrible crisis taking place in the life of King David. Let me show you both how and how not to respond when people in your life aren't there for you, criticize you when you're down, and turn their back on you and walk away when you need them the most. Let me show you how you should and should not respond. Now, David's life, as you might remember, is in terrible turmoil. 2 Samuel chapter 16, verse number 1, shows us as David is marching out of the city of Jerusalem, beyond the summit, he gets just beyond the summit of the Mount of Olives. And he's leaving Jerusalem because Absalom is coming in to take over Jerusalem, his own son, who has formed a coup and is taking over the political and military leadership of Israel. His own son has betrayed him and is kicking him out of town. Now, that's a crisis, a big crisis. He's running as a fugitive for his life. There is no guarantee of his income or his future or even his well-being. He's in big trouble. The military leaders, for the most part, have been held hostage, basically, in Hebron, 22 miles away. And now David is left with just his family and those that were left in the city, and he's gone. But as he's going past the summit of the Mount of Olives, it says a man named Ziba shows up. He is the steward, it says in verse 1, of Mephibosheth. And that may sound familiar to you because we've already seen David's dealings with this guy named Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth is the grandson of King Saul, and more importantly to David, he is the son of Jonathan. You might remember Jonathan, David's best friend, was killed on Mount Gilboa in a terrible military defeat in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. David, when he finally ascends to power in 2 Samuel, looks for any descendants of Jonathan. And he says, for Jonathan's sake, I want to be good to any of his descendants. Is anyone still alive? And sure enough, Ziba, who's hanging around the palace, says, I know someone, the grandson of Saul, the son of Jonathan, is still alive. And you know what? He's living in a place called Lo Debar. Well, David finds out he's a paraplegic. He can't walk. He has no real source of income, and he's probably living penniless from day to day in the city of Lo Debar. And David says, bring him here. And David brings Mephibosheth, a paraplegic, into the palace, and believe it or not, he gives him everything Saul ever owned. He says, all his real estate, all his family land, his bank accounts, everything. And by the way, I'm going to set a placard and a chair at my table, and you are welcome to come and eat amongst the king's son anytime you want, amongst the king's sons anytime you want. You can come in. I'm going to treat you like one of the family. Can you imagine? And Mephibosheth's response was overwhelming gratitude. Thank you. I can't believe you would do this for me. And David had poured his life into Mephibosheth with great generosity. And you know, you might expect some kind of friendship to grow out of that, and I'm sure there was. But in this passage, you don't see Mephibosheth showing up. You see Ziba, his servant, showing up. And he was waiting to meet David, and he had a string of donkeys saddled and loaded with all kinds of food, bread and raisin cakes and figs and a skin of wine. And David says to Ziba, why'd you bring these things? Obviously, these are Mephibosheth's things. Why are they here? Ziba says, well, you know, the donkeys are for you and your household to ride on. The bread and fruit are for the men to eat, and the wine is to refresh those who become exhausted in the desert. It's just for you, king. And the king says in verse 3, well, that's all well and fine, but where's Mephibosheth? Where's your master's grandson? And Ziba says to him, well, I hate to tell you this, Dave, but, you know, he's staying in Jerusalem. Actually, I heard him say something like this. He said, today, the house of Israel is going to give me back my grandfather's kingdom. I know that must hurt, Dave, but, you know, it seems like he's more into himself than you. I know you were really good to him, but, yeah, he ain't got time for you. David, verse 4, without any real description of his pain, but you know he's feeling it. He says to Ziba, fine, forget him then. All that belonged to Mephibosheth, it's yours. Ziba says, I humbly bow. May I find favor in your eyes, my lord the king. Now, the pain is not articulated for us, but you can imagine. You can imagine being left there in the midst of your trial with someone that you expected to be loyal and faithful and give you some support in the midst of your struggle, just driving by. See ya. You know, we are naturally inclined, I think, to do that, especially when we're hurting. And we have been vulnerable. We've been honest, open. With someone that is a fellow Christian, maybe in a small group, maybe in the lobby, maybe on the patio afterwards, maybe in a discipleship relationship, we've shared our heart, we've poured out our struggles. You took my message last week seriously, and you said, oh, we need to lean on the team, we need to have other Christians involved in our trial, and you've done it, you've opened up, you've been vulnerable, and then nothing. Spilled your guts at a small group. One person call you? No. Anybody write you a letter? No. Next Sunday, did anybody say how it's going? Not a person, not one person. And you feel abandoned. You feel ripped off. You feel like you tried to reach out for help and no one helped you. And it makes you angry. And much like David, you may respond the way David responds. Fine then, forget it. And that's what he does. He says, all of Mephibosheth's stuff is not his anymore. I'm taking it all back. I'm giving it to you. Ziba, it's yours. And he writes off his friend, a friend that he'd been committed to, a friend that he had been generous toward, and a friend who had pledged his faithful friendship and loyalty to. I mean, Mephibosheth had told David he'd be there for him, and David said, now that you're not here for me in my hour of need, forget you. Keep your finger here and turn with me to Matthew chapter 26. I want to show you, in contrast, how Jesus responds when his friends fail him. Because you know, don't you, that Jesus' friends failed him frequently. And there's probably no better illustration of this than this little snapshot of his life in the Garden of Gethsemane. Matthew chapter 26, you know the story well, but look at it with me if you would. Jesus is in the garden and he's troubled. Matter of fact, he's hitting an all-time emotional low. This is a kind of pain in his heart that he's never felt before. And the text says in verse 36 of Matthew 26 that Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, sit here while I go over there and pray. And he took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him. That's James and John. And he began to be sorrowful and troubled. That's what he felt. Verse 38, then he said to them, he revealed it to them. He exposed his pain to them. And he said, guys, Peter, James, John, my soul, it's overwhelmed with sorrow. What kind of sorrow? I'm telling you guys, this is a sorrow to the point of death. I mean, I'm feeling pain like I've never felt before. Stay here, please. Could you stay here with me and keep watch? I mean, I need to pray and I need to talk with God. Could you stay up here with me and help me through this time? And they stood there as they watched Jesus' forehead hit the dusty ground as he began to pray a prayer that sounded like this, my Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. And when he turned around and looked toward his disciples and saw them there, he found them sleeping. I mean, you could just feel the emotional, right? Like, where are you going? What's going on here? I told you, didn't I, that this is the most emotional pain I've ever felt? I didn't I make it clear that I'm troubled in my heart more than I've ever been? Haven't I asked you clearly to be here for me? I mean, haven't we spent 3 years together? And yet they're sleeping. And he addresses the problem. Could you men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? He asked Peter, verse 40. Now, that's what he said, but notice what he did not say. He did not say, you know what, you guys really don't care about me, do you? I thought I was your friend. Forget it. Forget it. Just get out of here. You guys go. Obviously, you're not interested in helping me. You know, I guess we weren't as close as I thought we were. It's not what he says. Oh, he addresses the problem. And he says, watch and pray. He tells him again, not get out of here. Come on, watch and pray with me so you won't fall into temptation. I know the spirit is willing, but the body is weak. He even sounds sympathetic here, doesn't he? I understand it. I mean, I get it. He went away a second time and he prayed, verse 42, my Father, if it's If it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, well, may your will be done. He went back again and found them sleeping. Their eyes were heavy. So he left them and he went away one more time and he prayed a third time and said the same thing. He returned to the disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour is near. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Now, this is critical in verse 46. Do you see what you see here? Third word, rise, let. What's the next word? Us. You know what I'd be saying at that point? See ya. I gotta go now. You're not gonna help me? Fine. Jesus, note it by what he does not say. He does not write off his friends. They failed him. Would you agree with that? They failed him. He did not write them off. He didn't say like David, fine, that if Mephibosheth's not gonna be here for me, then forget it. Let him go. I don't want to have anything to do with him anymore. But isn't that what we're tempted to say when someone doesn't come through for us and we expect for them to be sensitive and inquisitive and interested in our pain and they seem to not be? Man, don't do that. I put it this way in your outline. Jot it down. Give friends the benefit of the doubt. Write that down. Give friends the benefit of the doubt. You know what that is? That's the opposite of writing them off. Writing them off is, you know what? I don't need those guys then. Obviously, they're not my friends then. I'm not going back to that small group Bible study and sharing anything about my life again. I'm certainly not going to tell them my problems if obviously they're not even interested. And I asked them to pray and they said they would. And you know what? They didn't even ask me about it. When I mentioned it again, he acted like he didn't even know what I was talking about. Now, you realists out there heard me say, give your friends the benefit of the doubt, and your eyes kind of rolled back, right? Oh, you know, because you know that oftentimes people are more into themselves. And you're kind of concerned about that imperative that I've just laid out for you because you know people do fail you. And I've experienced that. And you know what? I'm not denying that. What I'm telling you is that you're smarter to give your friends the benefit of the doubt. You know why? Because more times than not, you will be right in giving them the benefit of the doubt. I'm not saying that sometimes they won't be just blowing you off. Sometimes people do that. But I'm saying if you give people who you think have reason to care about you, if you give them the benefit of the doubt that they do, even though they don't respond to you in a prescribed way that you think is the way they ought to respond to you, you know what? If you give them the benefit of the doubt, more times than not, you'll be right. Let me prove it to you. Here's an example from David's life. Turn back, if you would, to 2 Samuel. But instead of going all the way back to chapter 16, stop in chapter 19, and let me show you what happens. If we could roll the tape forward and see this scenario coming on the other end. In other words, the Absalom rebellion is now quelled. It's all over. It's quashed. And here comes David back into Jerusalem, marching back into Jerusalem, now with his son Absalom dead. Obviously, bitterness and heaviness of heart in David's chest. But he's coming back, and he's going to take the throne, and there's no more rebellion, no more uprising in the nation. And as he's coming back, guess in chapter 19, verse 24, who meets him? Look at it, verse 24. Uh-oh, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, David's son, or Jonathan's son, also went down to meet the king. Now notice, this is a very important historical notation. He had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day the king left until he returned safely. Now, if he was really looking to jockey for a position in the kingdom with Absalom, do you think he'd walk around like that? David is meeting Mephibosheth and he looks like a stinking mess. His mustache all out of whack. His feet just totally crudded over. His clothes, man, they're ugly and dirty and he stinks. And Dave says, wow, what's going on? And it was clear what was going on. He was mourning over David's departure. He was hurting. And he was hurting because he was loyal to David. And David says, look at this next verse. Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? And he said, my lord, the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I told my servant Ziba to get the donkey and saddle it up and I'd ride on it. But he didn't do it. I was going to come with you, but Ziba, he betrayed me. And he's also slandered me to you. I mean, I wasn't betraying you. Look at me. My lord, the king, you know, I mean, in my eyes, you're the greatest. You're like an angel of God. So do whatever pleases you, whatever you decide to do. If you want to believe him, that's fine. But I've been faithful and loyal to you. All my grandfather's descendants deserve nothing from you but death. But you gave your servant a place among those who sat at your table. So what right do I have to make any appeals to you, the king? The king said, why say more? In reality, he's saying, please don't say any more, right? How painful. Now I've already given all your stuff to Ziba. I don't know what to do. Just split your stuff up. And Mephibosheth said to the king, hey, man, let him take everything. Now that my lord the king's arrived home safely, that's all I cared about. Man, I've been praying for you, been mourning over you. Do you see how embarrassing a situation this is? David had written him off and given away all of his stuff. And guess who was in Jerusalem without any way to get out of Jerusalem, praying and mourning and caring every day for David and his safety? Mephibosheth. You know, that happens all the time. Back to our scenario on the I-5. If I was the guy driving by there, remember what I said to you in this story we told? I said, gotta go. And you took that as, you know what, he didn't care about me. You know, he's got his arm hanging out of his car, gotta go, right? See you Sunday. And you're thinking, jerk, that guy, he didn't care. And if your attitude was what I think it naturally is, write him off. Then you know what, you would have been wrong, because you know where I was going? I was headed to a funeral that morning. And when I passed you by and couldn't stop to help you with the flat tire, I didn't have a choice. Actually, there was a mother that had lost her young son, and I had to do the funeral at the El Toro Cemetery, and I couldn't stop. But I'll tell you what I did. I did get on my cell phone after I passed, and I called for help. Now, you may not have known that, but I also prayed for you for about 5 minutes as I was going. Now, I know you didn't realize that, and you didn't see that, but that's what was going on. So if you wrote me off, that wouldn't have been a good idea, because in reality, like Mephibosheth, you didn't really understand where my heart was. Do you know how often that happens? Do you know that sometimes you share your heart with someone and they don't respond in the way you expect them to? And you know, it's not that they don't care. It's that sometimes they don't know how to respond. They literally care, but they don't know how to respond. They don't know what to say. Sometimes they can't respond. Here's all I'm saying to you. Give your friends the benefit of the doubt. Because when you're in crisis, I think your tendency is, I have a need and I need it met now. And that myopic attitude, that myopic emotion keeps you from recognizing that sometimes people can't respond in the prescribed way that you think they should respond. And there's lots of factors involved. Give your friends the benefit of the doubt. Because more times than not, you'll be right. They do care. They just weren't able to help you the way you expected them to, when you expected them to. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 27. And there are some of you that are quick to write off your friends. You write them off because they're not sensitive and they don't respond right, and I thought they cared. You have those thoughts run through your head. When you do that, Proverbs 27 is a great reminder for us. It's not just a reminder. It's actually an imperative from God. It's a command. And God puts it this way. Verse 10, Proverbs 27:10. It says, do not forsake your friend, and don't forsake the friend of your father. Now, I'm going to really blow your mind because here's a really strange statement. And do not go to your brother's house when disaster strikes you. Does that sound like a weird statement? Don't go to your brother. Why not? Because the writer of this proverb is trying to infer that you ought to have friends. Because most of us should have more friends between our house and our brother's house that we shouldn't have to pass by our friends to get help in times of trouble to get to our house. And he says this, better is a neighbor nearby or a friend nearby than a brother far away. Do you know what the problem is with people that constantly write off their friends because they're not meeting their high standards of care? Do you know what the problem is with that? They're left with no one but their family. And I got news for you guys. Your family feels obligated to help you, right? I mean, that's part of the whole issue of family life. And God says you ought to have friends. Don't write them off. Don't forsake them. How are we going to prevent that? We got to always give them the benefit of the doubt because they are going to disappoint you and they're going to drive by the crisis of your life and seem uncaring, but give them the benefit of the doubt. Back to our story now. That's a good passage to keep in mind. We often do it, don't do it. When we do it, we're left with nothing but our family. Our family is great, but we ought to have more than our family, the Bible says. We ought to have Christian friends that surround our life that can be there in our trials. Verse 5, 2 Samuel 16. That's one thing to have a guy pass by who we think should help us and doesn't. It's another thing to be called an idiot for not having a spare tire, right? I mean, that's just another. That's a frontal attack. There's no confusing what he's trying to say. That's just painful, spiteful words. And you know what? David experienced that here in his crisis, verse 5. As King David approached Bahurim, a man came from the clan of Saul's family, and he came out from there. His name was Shimei, and he cursed as he came out. And he pelted David and all the king's officials with stones, though all his troops and the special guard were on David's right and left. As he cursed, Shimei said, get out, you man of blood, you scoundrel. Yahweh has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul, in whose place you've reigned. Yahweh has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom. You've come to ruin because you are a man of blood. Wow. You know, you're down, and now you got this guy kicking. You know, you got to note he's not a Philistine. He's not a Gittite. He's not any kind of foreigner here. He's an Israelite. He is throwing stones at the only sanctioned anointed king of Israel. He ought to be on your side, and he's not. He's that guy who you really don't know that well. When you expect him to help, he doesn't help. What he says hurts. And he gives his little armchair commentary on what your real problem is. You ever see this happening in the church? It happens all the time. You had a problem in your life. You share it with some people. You don't know them that well, but their response is very instructive. You know, if you had more faith in God, those kinds of things, you know, they wouldn't bother you. Or, you know, you share some issue with them and they say, well, you know, are you even in the Word, man? You know, you spend time in the Bible? Because I can't imagine that, you know, you'd be struggling with that. Or they say things like this, you know, when I was an immature Christian, I had those problems too. They say, you know, something must be really wrong in your life if you're having all those things happen to you. There must be some sin there. We often think of Job being this great example of a godly man, but you know, his friends wore him down. First chapter, oh, praise God, he gives, he takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. By chapter 6, he's fed up, right? These guys come in, try and help him, and he says, miserable comforters are you all. Just go home. He compares them to a well that travelers pass by and try to go get a drink out of, and they find that it's dry. He says, that's what you guys are like. Here's how he puts it. You're of no help. And sometimes we have people trying to parse and define our Christian life with their little interpretations of why we're struggling. And basically, we feel like they've just called us an idiot for not having a spare tire. You know what I'm saying? What's wrong with you? You know what our natural reaction is when people do that to us? It's spelled out in the next verse. I love it. Abishai. Abishai in David's army, son of Zeruiah, says to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, here's the feeling we have, and cut off his head. You gotta like a man of action like that. Let me just lop his head off. Now I'm the king, and I'm probably gonna say something like this. Hurry back, right? Sure, because you know what? I have not shed any of Saul's blood. I am not a man of blood. I've been good to Saul and his descendants. This guy does not have his facts straight. What is wrong with him? Let's fight. You want to fight about this? Especially because I got the truth and I got the equipment on my side. If you want to criticize me, I'm going to fight back. I don't want you thinking that about my life because you're wrong. You know what? That seems to be a natural reaction. And Abishai has it, but that is not a godly reaction. And though David had a snap judgment and he jumped to conclusions with Mephibosheth, I think his response here is very godly. Verse 10. King says, man, you and I are so different. What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? He says that because Zeruiah's other son is Joab, and Joab was the guy that in a fit of rage killed Abner, Saul's right-hand man. I don't remember all that, but I mean, they're a couple of hotheads. And he says, you know what? We're not into revenge and retaliation here. It's not time for that. And then he puts this little theological thought in it. He said, if his cursing is because Yahweh said to him, curse David, then who can ask, why do you do this? Did you hear what he just said? What if God wants him to be saying that to me? If God wants him to be criticizing me right now, who in the world can shut him down? What is he saying? It's interesting. He's got this bent toward, maybe I should listen a little bit to what he's saying. Maybe there's a nugget of truth in this. Oh, I know I haven't killed Saul's descendants, but maybe it's time for that. As a matter of fact, look at the circumstances of my life. Perhaps it's time for me to be hearing some things from God. Verse 11, David says to Abishai and all his officials, my son, my own flesh and blood, Absalom, he's trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for Yahweh has told him to. Or at least he's assuming he might be. And if Yahweh has told him to, and I'm not going to be the king anymore, this is my kick in the pants on the way out, then fine, I'll bear it. But, he says, it may be that the Lord will see my distress. In other words, it may be that this is not appropriate criticism. And then, you know what? God will take care of me. He'll repay me with good for the cursing I'm receiving today. Wow. What a perspective. There's a man named Samuel Logan Bringle who preached about 100 years ago with the Salvation Army, in the heyday of the Salvation Army. And he used to go out and preach on street corners and everywhere. And well, the hecklers back then were a little bit more forthright than the hecklers today. One time he was out standing up for Christ, and someone in the crowd threw a brick at him. And it hit him right on the top of the head. And he went down, and he was taken to the hospital, and he was sent home to recover from an injury to the head. In his recovery bed at home, he began to write some things on some notes that he had. And he ended up, out of that experience, writing a book. And that book that he wrote was really the most famous book he'd ever written. It's called Helps to Holiness. And it was read in the turn of the 19th or the 20th century. It was read by hundreds of people. Thousands of people read this book. And it was a great encouragement and help to people in their walk with Christ and trying to pursue holiness. And the Bringle family had a little saying in response to that experience in his life, and it went something like this: no brick, no book. And their perspective was, if that hadn't happened, then he wouldn't have been able to write that book. He would not have been even down on his back long enough to do it. And you know what? Something good came out of it. Mrs. Bringle actually kept the brick. And I don't know where she kept it, maybe over the sink or on the mantle or the fireplace. She kept the brick and she inscribed on it Genesis 50, verse 20. You know that verse? When Joseph turned to his brothers and said, "You guys, you intended it for evil against me, but God intended it for good." Wow. He had this attitude that, you know what? The brick on the head was my cue from God to do something. And though it was meant maliciously, God worked through that criticism and through that confrontation to really do something in my life that led to fruit and ministry, and in this case, a book that helped thousands of people. Matter of fact, I was so impressed by the story of Bringle. If you start looking at the stuff that he did, one thing that just really stood out in the life of Samuel Bringle was a letter he wrote in response to his critics. Now, you stand up for Christ and you preach, you're going to get a lot of people, you know, got a lot of armchair commentary on what you're doing wrong, and Bringle was no exception, and sure enough, he got some pretty heated, critical letters. Well, one of the letters that he wrote back was one I happened to read, and this came from Bringle's own hand, and it was signed by Bringle, and he said this to one of the nastiest hate letters he'd received, and here's what he said. He said, "I thank you for your criticism of my life. It has led me to self-examination and heart-searching and prayer, which always leads me to a deeper sense of my utter dependence on Jesus Christ. Thank you, Samuel Logan Bringle." I thought, now there's another approach, right? That's not cutting off the head of your critic. That's really taking a careful look at what's being said and rejecting what's not true, looking for what is, and even if nothing is true, you know what it's led you to? It's led you to a deeper sense of commitment and dependence on God. It's led you to a new level of soul searching in your own life to see if everything's really where it needs to be. And you know what? Guys like Samuel Bringle teach us to use our critics as stepping stones to future spiritual growth. I put it this way in your outline, number two, don't be defensive. Because you know, when you end up being defensive, you never learn from the critical remarks. You never use them, even if they're not true. You never get to use them as stepping stones to spiritual growth. As a matter of fact, what happens is you waste all your energy in dealing with your crisis at shaking your fist at the guy who called you an idiot for not having a spare tire in your trunk. Don't worry about that guy. Don't worry about what they think. Don't worry about what they say. Let them drive on and think you're an idiot. But you know what? The bottom line is you got a tire to fix, so you got to work on that. And in your crisis, there'll be lots of people squawking at you about what your problem is and the reason you're having marital problems or the reason you're infertile or the reason you got financial problems or the reason you're not making it at work, and they got all these opinions about it. You know what? Just listen. Maybe God's got truth there. Maybe he doesn't. But the bottom line is if you're being unduly criticized, God will take care of you and reward you. If you're patient and self-controlled, And if it's true, then you can learn from some of that. But it's not worth fighting. Don't be defensive. So David puts up with it. Verse 13. David and his men continued along the road while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing him as he went, throwing stones and showering him with dirt. Can you see this? And the king and all the people with him finally arrived at their destination exhausted. And there, David refreshed himself. Meanwhile, verse 15, Absalom and all the men of Israel came to Jerusalem. Here's the upstart rebel king, the son of David, the wayward son of David. Here's the most painful sentence in this whole text. And Ahithophel was with him. And that's painful because, as I've told you before, Ahithophel was one of David's best friends. Ahithophel was one of David's most trusted advisors. Ahithophel was the right-hand man sitting in the cabinet of the Israeli government with David. And he was not only a trusted advisor, he was a good companion. He was a friend. And now he's distanced himself from David, and he has been taken into the rebellion by Absalom, and now he's the advisor to his rebel son. Now, David's got a friend, Hushai the Archite, there that's trying to help him out, and that's explained in 16 through 19. More on that next week. But look at verse 20. Absalom turns to Ahithophel and says, you know what? I need your advice now. We're in the city. We've come into Jerusalem. We're here. We got most of Israel behind us, but what should I do now? And Ahithophel answers, and he says, I got a plan. Can you imagine this? Now picture this coming from the mouth of your former best friend. I know what you should do. You should lie with your father's concubines whom he left to take care of the palace. Remember, there were 10 ladies that were left to take care of the palace. They were David's concubines. And he says, I know what you should do. You know, if you would just lie with them, all of Israel would hear about that. And you know what? You would burn the ships. You would burn the bridges. It would be clear there's no turning back and that you were shaking your fist at Dave. And you know what? The rebellion would be firmly established. You'd become a stench in your father's nostrils, and the hands of everyone with you would be strengthened. So, based on Ahithophel's advice, they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and the unthinkable happened. He laid up there on the top with this big awning that was set up so that everyone could see him, and he sat there all afternoon and had sex with David's concubines. Thanks, best friend. Appreciate that. That's betrayal. How deep of a betrayal is it? Look at the next verse. In those days, the advice Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. I mean, his advice was gold. That was how both David in former times and Absalom now regarded all of Ahithophel's advice. David had his complete confidence in Ahithophel, and now David's son, Absalom, is putting his complete confidence in Ahithophel, and that advice is sitting there and destroying David and turning all of Israel against him. You know, Jesus not only knew what it was like to say to Peter, James, and John, guys, I need you, would you pray with me, and have them snoring in a few minutes, but he also knew what it was like to have his trusted treasurer, his name, of course, is the name that brings up and conjures up the word itself, betrayal, Judas, who I say was the most trusted because everyone thought he was the greatest guy and everyone put so much confidence in him, he held the money bag. And Jesus knew what it was like to see Judas, his betrayer, walk up and kiss him on the cheek and show people with torches and clubs and swords and daggers, that's the guy, arrest him, get him, give me my 30 pieces of silver, please. And though it's hard to be neglected, and it's hard to be criticized. Nothing is harder than having someone we walk with closely stab us in the back, especially when we're down. And you know what? Jesus knew what that was about. And he felt that pain. And you know what? I hate to say it, but if Jesus had his Judas and David had his Ahithophel, sometime in your Christian experience, you are probably going to experience this kind of betrayal, where someone you trust in, someone you go on vacations with, someone you call your good friend is going to turn around and stab you in the back. And I don't say that with any joy in my heart. I say it because it's an unfortunate reality of the sinful condition of men's hearts. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about because in your scenario, you pictured your best friend as your spouse, didn't you? And that would be unthinkable, but it happens. Where you have a spouse who goes to church with you, and has for years claimed to be a follower of Christ, and you, of course, have been as vulnerable and open to them as anyone can possibly be to anyone else. And one day they decide to betray you. And if you're going through that, all I can tell you is I know that that is a grave pain that Jesus has felt. And it is a pain of betrayal that David has felt. And it is a kind of betrayal that needs only one basic response. And unfortunately, in our passage, the historical narrative does not record it for us, but it's almost too sacred to be stuck here in a list of facts about the history of David's life. And so it's relegated to Psalm 55, a psalm that he probably wrote by the moonlight sitting out at the fords of the Jordan River with a heart aching and tears flowing down the sides of his cheeks and onto his beard. And David said, I know what it's like to be betrayed. And turn there with me and look at these words. Psalm 55, David writes this about Ahithophel. Even the ancient, most ancient translations of the Old Testament have Ahithophel's name scribbled in the margins. And all the rabbis and scholars for years have known that the person David is talking about in Psalm 55 is Ahithophel. And look at what David says. Drop your eyes down in this passage to verse number 12. David says, you know, if it were an enemy that was insulting me, I could endure it. And he's proved that, hadn't he? Shimei wants to come out and throw some dirt clods at me. You know, I can handle that. If it were a foe that were raising himself up against me, I could hide from him. But it's you, Ahithophel, my companion, a man like myself, my close friend, the friend with whom I once enjoyed sweet fellowship. Man, we went to church together. We studied the Bible together. We prayed together. We walked among the throng at the house of God. David says, let death take my enemies by surprise. Let them go down alive into the grave, for evil finds lodging with them. Look at verse 16. But you know what? I'll call on God, and Yahweh saves me. Evening and morning and noon, I'll cry out in my distress, and he hears my voice. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. Verse 20, my companions, they attack their friends, and he, Ahithophel, violates his covenant with me, his friendship with me. It is busted up. His speech, it was as smooth as butter, yet there was war in his heart. There must have been. His words were soothing like oil, and yet underneath all that were drawn swords. I can't believe it. You want to know David's advice for someone who's been betrayed? Here it is, coming up, verse 22. Here's some good words for you to underline. When the worst happens and the guy you expect to count on or the gal you expect to count on in the time of trouble, who's your best buddy, ends up sabotaging your life. Look at it. Cast your cares on Yahweh. He will sustain you. David knew it well. Psalm 27 says the same thing. If my mother and father forsake me, and in that case he says they do, you know what will happen? The Lord will take me up. Oh, I trust in friends, and I'm not negating or opposing anything I said last week. We are to lean on the body of Christ, and David is still exercising that kind of mentality. He's got Hushai in there with Ahithophel. He's got the Abathar, the priest, and Zadok, the priest, and their two sons working for him. He's got friends. He's leaning on his companions. But when the best friend that he's had in the past ends up being a betrayer, there's nowhere else to go but to God. Oh, he's not shutting everybody out. He's not saying, I won't trust anybody ever again. But he does have a pain that no other friendship can replace. And in that pain, he says, I've got to cast my cares on Yahweh. And I know he'll sustain me. Look at these next words. He will never let the righteous fall. You know what? He's going to pick me up. He's not going to let me be utterly broken. Look at these last words in verse 23. But as for me, you know, whatever else you do to take care of this guy, that's your business. But God, as for me, I trust in you. I trust in you, and I'm going to do what you want me to do, and I'm going to believe that you're a God that can pick me up when everyone else lets me down. I put it this way in your outline, number 3. Lean on your perfect friend, because that's your only place to go when the people you thought were your best friends let you down. And you've got to go there. You've got to retreat there in the silence of your home. In the quiet times, early in the morning, you got to say, God, I need you. Late at night, when you're lonely and feel criticized and you feel abandoned and you feel attacked and betrayed, you got to lean on God. You got to say, God, I know you're the kind of God. And Christ, you, the one knowing the pain of betrayal, are the kind of Christ that said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. The last words of Matthew, lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. I'm going to be there no matter what. He said in the book of John, I'll never leave you orphans. You're not going to be alone. And you're going to have to lean on your perfect friend. There's a man named Henry Dempsey who commuted often from Portland, Maine to Boston. And he got in his commuter plane and he was flying to Boston. And on the way, as they were going over the Atlantic coast there, he heard a rattling in the back of the plane. Decided to go and take a look, and so he did. And he went to the little portal window there that's in the middle of the back door. And he looked out at the wing, the back tail wing, to see if he could see anything. But Henry was in for a huge surprise because it wasn't the tail that was rattling, it was the door that was rattling. And they hit an air pocket. True story, the door flung open and sucked Henry right out of the plane. Lights come on the front board of the cockpit. Pilot sees what's going on. He gets on his radio. Oh, my goodness. He wires, radios for the nearest airport. I need an emergency landing. I need it right now. And by the way, I need helicopters to go back and look for this guy. And he gave his coordinates and told them where to search for this guy. They turned the plane back, and they went to the nearest airport, and they landed safely. Interesting thing they found. Mr. Dempsey had actually caught the ladder rung on the outside of the plane and was hanging on when they landed. Alive and well, quite scared. But he had hung on at 4,000 feet, commuter plane going 200 miles an hour, and it took 20 minutes to get from the time the door flung open to the time they landed. And there was Dempsey. Paper said it took quite a long time to peel his fingers off the ladder rung. Can you imagine what that 20 minutes must have been like? That's what those times feel like. No one comes to the door, lends a helping hand. Nobody there to throw out a rope. And sometimes in your life, everything falls apart and there's nothing left to do but hang on. And if you feel lonely, betrayed, if you feel like your friends have been insensitive, if you really have been stabbed in the back by someone close to you, all I got to say to you is if you hang on, the Bible promises He will sustain you. When your friends fail you, God will pick you up. So hang on. God is a good God. He's a faithful God. And God will get you through it. And you've got to hang on tight. Don't despair. God, it's an unfortunate message that we have to proclaim. And I wish it weren't true that friends in our lives will at various points let us down, but most of us here know from experience that it's true. People that should be supporting us are criticizing us. People we expect to be there for seem interested in other things. And close companions end up being the cause of our trial. God, as long as we're in this present state, we know this will be a reality, so we want to prepare for it. We want to prepare by trusting in You and hanging on tight and not retaliating and giving our friends the benefit of the doubt when we're not sure. God, help us to hang on, particularly for those that are going through their crisis right now and they feel like they're in the middle of that 20-minute plane ride. God, help them to hang on tight. To know that if their mother and father forsakes them, the Lord will pick them up. The Lord will take them. And God, help us all as the body of Christ to be better at caring for one another's needs. And may this place be a place where we can hang on together. Get us through our trials, God. But in the process, give us overwhelming confidence that no matter what happens, and no matter who's faithful and loyal, and no matter who betrays us, that You are a God that is worthy of our confidence, that takes care of His kids no matter what happens. Give us that, and in the process, make us stronger, more spiritual, more complete, and lacking in nothing. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.